Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. House Bill 1057 seeks to criminalize gender-affirming clinical care in South Dakota. As that bill makes its way through the South Dakota State Legislature, Republican leader Lee Qualm recently told the New York Times that he's hearing from voters with vastly different opinions about the bill. That bill is scheduled for debate in the House tomorrow. So what are some of the procedures that this legislation seeks to block? What does the data tell us about variations in gender identity and gender expression? We have invited Ann Dillenschneider to join us. She's been working with transgender youth and adults since 1992. She's one of only 87 providers in the world and the only healthcare provider in the Dakotas who has earned the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Specialty Credential in transgender healthcare. And she's joining us now from the SDPB Sioux Falls studios as we broadcast today from the SDPB Black Hills studios. Ann, welcome back. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
There is so much to talk about today with this, but I want to start with one of the basic sort of fundamental questions that people are asking about this legislation and about gender expression in general, is this a defect? Is this something that is wrong or unhealthy? What are the variations of gender expression? Is this a pathology?
It's actually not a pathology. In 2018, the World Health Organization, which is made up of 194 countries, determined that it's actually not a mental health condition, it's a medical condition. And that was ratified on May 25th of 2019. And in the new ICD-11, which is the coding that all medical professionals and hospitals use, that will be effective of January 1st of 2022, it will be coded as a medical condition. And this is based on research we've had over the last 40, 50 years that shows us that gender is related to at least 12 DNA markers. It's also related to brain structures and also hormone receptivity in utero. So it's fairly complicated, but it is a medical condition. And the mental health conditions we see associated with that have to do with discrimination and stigma. So it's a big change, but it's one that we, who have been working in the field for a long time, knew was coming.
Yeah. How fast is the research moving forward? Would you say, you know, not fast enough? Or do you think that, you know, people are sort of waking up to the idea that this is something that we need to research and understand more completely, particularly before we pass legislation?
Well, there's been research for a good 50 years. And so it's getting better all the time. We're doing more longitudinal studies. Those are really important.
Explain what that means.
A longitudinal study means something we're doing over a long period of time, like over 10, 20 years. We follow people and see how things are going. The studies are just so important in terms of determining best evidence-based practice of care, and that's where the World Professional Association for Transgender Health comes into play. That is impacted, of course, with the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, the American Medical Association, the American Counseling Association. All of those are players in determining good evidence-based practice.
Let's talk about gender care in general, because when the House legislation was first presented, as it's written, there's a long list of procedures. Right. Some of them are recognizable, like mastectomy. Most people know what that means because of cancer care for adult women. Other procedures, you would have to get a dictionary to look up and see what that means. There's no one-size-fits-all, and that's a very important point to bring out. But in general, for families who are dealing with gender expression, gender identity, transgender youth, what are some of those overall, parameters of care? Where do you begin with the questions that you're asking and the kind of care that you might need to receive?
So, yeah, let's go to the beginning. So, if a child, presents as gender diverse. Basically, at this point, what we're doing is a gender affirmative model, which basically is we follow the lead of the child because we want to make sure the child has secure attachment with parents. We want to make sure that the child is resilient. And so really not a lot is done for children before puberty, except to be supportive. those of us who are trained in doing differential diagnosis can do that. We do know that there's a high correlation between, for instance, autism spectrum, especially high-functioning autism, which used to be known as Asperger's, and being transgender or gender diverse. So that's something that since 2016, best practice is we screen for both. And I have had a child who turned out to simply have high functioning autism and was not trans. And so very, very careful differential diagnosis work is done, whether it's youth, children, youth, or adults. There are procedures that we do. And so we basically support families, do a lot of education, because remember, a family is transitioning and living into this difference as a whole support team. So I'm always working with parents. I don't do any diagnostic work without the parents. The parents are part of the support team.
What kind of questions would you ask, you know, mom or dad? So, I mean, I remember having friends whose son, his favorite color was pink.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very simple thing, but already they were saying, does this mean anything? Does it mean anything that his color is pink and that he likes princesses? And there was this sort of, you know, no, it doesn't mean he likes pink. Give him something pink. Yeah. And it really, I mean, he liked pink for a while, and then he liked other colors too. And so when you, but it goes beyond that, where a kid might come home and say, you know, more to a family. What are some of the questions you ask his or her, their parents, their guardians?
Well, there are questions about how is this child comfortable? What does this child play with? How does this child talk about themselves? Who do they relate to? So there are children who will insist that I'm a boy. And their body, their sex, which is different from gender, gender's inside, sex is outside. Their sex may be female, but they may insist they're a boy. Just roll with that. But we do ask questions. We do a lot of observation. Sometimes it's just that they like boys' clothes more and they're more comfortable, or they like pink, or they like blue, or they like whatever. It's a lot of watching. So we have questions within the diagnostic manual. I think there are 8 that we watch for. And when we move to the ICD-11, there's another set of questions. Under the DSM-5, the diagnostic manual in the U.S. right now, it's a 6-month period that we watch, but under the ICD-11, it will be 2 years. So it's tighter, and we simply watch and are supportive. When puberty happens, things start to change a little bit. But the first thing that needs to be clear about this bill is there's nothing other than mental health support, family support, before what's called Tanner Stage 2, which is a particular part of puberty. So there really doesn't need to be a concern about that, any kind of medical intervention, because it's not happening.
Right. So part of the genesis of this bill comes from Fred Deutsch, mm-hmm. who, you know, did some internet searching and had some concerns,
right.
and wants to protect, in his words, vulnerable children.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he told the New York Times in their recent report, and we've spoken with him as well, mm-hmm. and consistently he says, let's not rush things. There might be regret. It's time to hit pause. Slow things down. Would you address that a little bit? This notion of, you know, this can move quickly, and we need to legislatively hit the pause button.
Okay, so nothing moves quickly at all, ever. So like I say, you know, it will be up to 2 years just for children, and that's not even medical treatment. When we get to regret factors, that's about 1%. There are some earlier flawed studies that were inaccurate and have been proved to be flawed that a lot of people will try to go back to. But it's really important to read the research, because when we misstate what research is saying, we can skew things. And so, for instance, at one point this year, there was a big thing about how over 6,000 men died on Lupron as adults, so we shouldn't give it to children to pause puberty. Well, if you read the study, it said 6,370 elderly men with prostate cancer died of prostate cancer, and they had been prescribed Lupron for palliative care. Mm-hmm. Well, that's different. It's
right.
Completely different. So research, if somebody's citing, asked to see the research someone is citing and actually read it and read the follow-up papers to see if that research is actually holding true or not. But it's a long process. So with children, you know, typically I'm working with the family, I may be working with a pediatrician. Once we get to puberty, then a whole number of things come into play, but that means I'm working with the family practitioner or pediatrician, I'm working with an endocrinologist, and I'm working with the family. So we're constantly building a team, and everybody's on the same page. It takes a great deal of time. It takes hours and hours to do a good diagnosis. And the other thing that should be said in that diagnostic part again is that sometimes, yes, people were misdiagnosed, especially before 20, 30 years ago, before we understood the connections between autism spectrum and transgender diagnoses. So somebody may well have been misdiagnosed. So it's not that it's regret they were misdiagnosed, you know. So, but once then, with during the time of puberty until somebody's 16, really the only intervention could be, and isn't always, but can be doing what's called puberty suppression. And so what we do is we put puberty on pause so that breasts don't develop, periods stop, body hair doesn't develop further. And what that does is it lowers the distress that children are often feeling. It's really hard to do good assessment. It's hard to help children move forward developmentally as teens if they're in distress, if they mm-hmm. can't even look at their body in the mirror or take a shower, or if they're self-harming. And so I've watched kids go from being, you know, in the inpatient unit repeatedly every month with their period to being okay and fine. It's about saving lives, because the suicide attempt rate can be as high as 60%.
Right. And let's talk about this report, 60%. Yeah, yeah. That's not, we don't want to brush past that. But no. I do want to talk about this report from the American Association of Pediatrics that said specifically the suicide rate can drop a great deal. I don't have the exact number in front of me. If you do, please.
4%.
Drop down to 4%. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. If those puberty blocking gender care is provided, help us understand this study, please.
So it's with gender. It's with family support is a big factor, but also the puberty blocking or whatever the child needs. Not every child needs puberty blocking, right? But once we get supportive care in, and the statistics you can find many of them, but it'll go from 31% to 60% of suicide attempts. We're not talking suicidal thoughts; we're talking suicide attempts. So this is about saving lives. Right. And it's a conversation. You know, I'm having a conversation with the family for many hours before I send a referral to the endocrinologist. The endocrinologist, in turn, is having several hours of conversation with the family as well, constant monitoring. Right. Nothing happens without all this conversation. We're all in contact. The saddest thing for me is people who say that they're supportive of kids and they want to protect children, then why isn't transgender mental health covered under South Dakota's Medicaid?
Right. I want to go and I would read directly from the Association of American Pediatrics statement. And they said, transgender teens who were able to receive treatments to suppress puberty were less likely to ever consider suicide. Mm-hmm. Researchers found high levels of anxiety and depression are common among transgender youth. Right. Studies have found as many as 40% of transgender adults have ever attempted suicide. So the numbers are pretty stark there. And this is a different kind of hitting pause. Fred Deutsch is saying, hit pause, don't move forward too quickly. And what we're seeing in the research is if you hit pause on puberty and development, that can give people that treatment, which House Bill 1057 seeks to criminalize, can really help save lives, specifically regarding suicide and suicide ideation. Do I understand that correctly? Am I getting
right.
those facts right?
Yeah, it's right. And it's a Canadian study that has the 60%. There's another one that's 31%. And those are both on adolescents. The one you cite's about adults, but it's over their lifetime. So yes, the bill's way of putting things on pause, which doesn't stop puberty, means that literally people are in the inpatient unit constantly because they want to mutilate their bodies. They're so miserable. They're so distressed. It because their bodies keep developing in the way that doesn't match who they see who they are, and if you want to help, help us pause puberty, support our medical providers. And they are not functioning in a vacuum either. Remember, they're going under the guidelines of the Endocrinology Society and the American Medical Association. So we have so many sets of guidelines, even the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, WPATH, those guidelines are 120 pages that right. we're following. So we don't get to things like, you know, when they talk about mastectomies or HRT or what they call lower surgeries, none of that is happening in the way this bill states. And that's a problem. Lower surgery doesn't happen until someone's an adult. We don't do it in South Dakota because we don't have the capabilities here. Mastectomy, that depends on a medical team. And that, again, is usually when someone's 18. We don't even begin to think about estrogen or testosterone until the earliest 16. Right. So the biggest thing the bill's impacting is the blocking of puberty. And that's absolutely critical for keeping these kids alive.
I want to quote also from or read directly from those standards of care because I want to get at this idea of how the conversation like the one we're having now can be incredibly healthy mm-hmm. as people have a great number of questions. And sometimes an internet search is not the best way to come up with, the evidence-based facts, right?
Right.
But it also, these conversations, and I'm always, you know, critically aware of this, can have another impact as well on people who are being talked about, as you and I are talking about mm-hmm. transgender people, and that's not our lived experience. So right. It says in these standards of care, health is also dependent on good clinical care, but it is also on social and political equality and full rights of citizenship. Speak right. a little bit, Anne, if you will, about the impact on parents and children of the debate when people say things about, gender care is child abuse and, transgender people are sick. What can this add to the overall healing and health, overall health process of families and individuals?
Wow. I mean, I do have, a child that heard an elected official talk disparagingly about transgender people. It's a younger child. Like 9 years old, who tried to commit suicide right after hearing that because they were so distraught. I mean, the things that are being said publicly really, really do impact people a great deal. And, we work with parents. Parents know their kids, and it's helping us understand each child. And so one way to sometimes help people understand what's going on is that, and I learned this from some nurses back in 1994, bless their hearts, and they were the ones who explained to me that sex and gender are often chosen at birth quite a bit, and that there's up to 5 million people in the United States who, when they were born, we could not tell if they were a girl or a boy. That's a lot of people, and we don't talk about that, and that's called being intersex. And it's quite possible that if we can't tell what gender someone is on the outside when they're born, that we might not know on the inside either for quite a while. And so with parents, when they're noticing something different, my job is to support them, to explore with them, to get education. There are other parents who've been through this, but also to work with schools and places of worship, workplaces, is that nobody should be discriminated against, that we all have a right to feel safe and to explore who we are. And when the conversation gets into the level it is right now, and some of the things that have been said, it's absolutely terrifying to both families and to children and adolescents.
And very briefly, what are you hearing from healthcare providers about House Bill 1027 or 1057 and some of their concerns?
Really disturbed that it is interfering with the patient and doctor relationship and the relationship that the doctor has with the families. It goes against best practice. It puts patients at risk. I mean, if we're supposed to be doing no harm and saving lives, and that's where our best treatment protocols lead us, and we're being, medical providers are being forbidden to do that life-saving work, that's a problem. It really is.
And Dylan Schneider has been working with transgender youth and adults since the early 90s, and she is the only healthcare provider in South Dakota who has earned World Professional Association for Transgender Health Specialty Credential in Transgender Healthcare. Anne, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori, for getting the word out.